and we have started to change the way we create content and the right format for the content, because things that work in the past for Google search are not working for Gemini, or work differently for Gemini or ChatGPT or other chatbots. So we need to adjust the type of content and the structure of the content in order to meet the new algorithm.
Can you think of any specific examples? Are you talking about FAQs, short form versus long form, snippets? Like what is there a specific thing you're doing differently for AI?
Yeah, we found out, for instance, that those tools really love structure formats, like tables. You don't have to show the borders of the tables, but once the output, the content is built in the format of the table, it's easier for those tools to capture the data.
Welcome to How I Made It in Marketing from Marketing Sherpa. We scour pitches from hundreds of creative leaders and uncover specific examples, not just trending ideas or buzzword-laden schmaltz, real-world examples to help you transform yourself as a marketer. Now, here's your host, the Senior Director of Content and Marketing at Marketing Sherpa, Daniel Burstein, to tell you about today's guest.
Wherever you are in your career today, you're not necessarily stuck there. I've heard time and again from guests on How I Made It in Marketing about how they've been able to make dramatic, perhaps unlikely career shifts. On the flip side, if you're a hiring manager, do not pigeonhole potential recruits based on only their current experience. For as my next guest puts it, look past the CV. We'll hear the story behind how he learned that lesson in his career, along with many more lesson-filled stories from Tomer Zucker, VP of Marketing at DID. Thanks for joining us, Tomer.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Daniel. Nice to meet you and nice to be here.
Well, let me tell the audience a little bit about your background real quick so they understand who they're listening to. Tomer spent 12 years at Microsoft. He held roles in sales and marketing and left as a channel executive for multinational accounts. He also worked at IBM, where he worked in marketing, and he was a business unit manager of security software for the cognitive solutions division in IBM. He was the head of partner marketing for Amazon Web Services. And for the past year, he's been the VP of marketing for DID. DID has raised $47 million overall, including $25 million in a Series B round of funding led by Macquarie Capital 2 years ago. And Tomer manages a team of 10 marketers in addition to freelancers and agencies. So Tomer, give us a sense, what is your day like as a brand strategist?
Wow. Working for a startup in the hyper-dynamic domain of generative AI, which is, I think, the front line of the industry, it's really crazy. It's a nice mixture between brand and performance, between marketing and product, and marketing and sales. So it's all around. Last year, we had a very interesting and strategic process of rebranding, reshaping the strategy of the company. I had the pleasure and the opportunity to lead this process from a marketing perspective. And now, since the beginning of 2024, it's the time of execution, executing all the brand strategies that we have designed back then in 2023. So it's super exciting. From a marketing perspective, to deal with, the new branding, the new voice, the new narrative, and to do that in a fast-paced industry like AI industry, which is crazy.
All right. Well, I'm sure we're going to learn a lot of lessons from that. Not to mention, as we mentioned, your entire career, sales, marketing, channel, All that stuff, right? It's going to be great. So let's take a look at some of the lessons from the things you made. That's a great thing we get to do as marketers, get to make things, right? I've said before, I've never been an actuary or a podiatrist, but I don't feel like they make things, right? We make things. Like you said, you make a brand, we make things. So your first lesson is look past the CV. So how did you learn that lesson, Tomer?
Yeah. So my story as a marketing didn't start at my marketing. Marketing was my passion, but I've started my journey in sales. And to be honest, after spending a few years with sales, around 30% of my career, 35% as a professional was in sales. And this is one of the first recommendations I share with students and junior marketeers and even senior marketeers. Spend few years working with sales, at sales, create these kind of frictions with real customers. And I had the opportunity to do that. So I spent a few years working for enterprise sales, That time it was at Microsoft. Super complex, you know, sales cycles, very, you know, demanding customers, you know, big enterprises, retailers, manufacturers, and financial services company and such. But my heart, my passion was in marketing. But, you know, I don't know if you had the chance to work with big corporation, but once you are like being tagged as a salesperson, it's really hard to switch from another for other disciplines. And it's like, this is like the complexity of life. So I needed to create like this kind of a bridge, I would say, between sales and marketing, and create my own opportunities, and hopefully to get this kind of chance. And lucky for me, I did get a chance. One of the senior marketing manager, he managed a team at the marketing division, probably saw something in me as a human being above the CV, beyond the, you know, the LinkedIn profile or my CV, and saw like a spark of marketing, you know, potential over there. And what I did at that time is trying to get closer and closer from the sales discipline into the marketing. And I asked for a few opportunities to do like small projects, to run events, to create a plan. And once I establish this kind of trust from this marketing senior marketing manager at me, I've started to get more and more opportunities and waited for the right timing. And the right timing reached to me. One of the people I helped them as a marketeer, it was on, by the way, on top of my day work as a salesperson. It was like my extra time, which I didn't have. But that was my passion in. So he opened a new position in the company, and he was approached to me and asked me if this is something I would like to do. It was very, you know, innocent question. And of course, I jumped into that. And I took it and as much as I can, and invest all of myself into these opportunities, and it went great, to be honest. I had to run like a mini campaign in order to sell myself, because I was not the ideal, you know, candidate. I was lack of like ordinary or traditional marketing backup, because I came from sales. And before of that, I did some techie roles. So I've started my journey in a techie role. I did QA, professional services. So my background was not like the ideal candidate. But again, this person saw something beyond my CV and gave me the chance, which I'm super thankful for that. And by the way, this is something I really adopt as a manager along my career. And I have more than one, two, three cases when I open the door for people that are not coming from a pure marketing discipline, and even not the exact expertise they have as marketeers, just to give people a chance if I see something that is lying there and it's beyond the CV. For instance, given an opportunity for a marketing manager that run a marketing for a ballet group, right? Dancing is far, far, far away from tech, right? Or someone that was a digital marketing manager in the Ministry of Finance in the government, right? Different the sector, completely different sector. And I have more than one example like that. So I'm trying, when I interview people, just, you know, to dive into their personality, their curiosity, their passions, and their values, and to see if I can, you know, close those gaps. Just make, you know, the things happen, like the opportunity I got.
So that's a really interesting background. You said you went to marketing, you'd already had that sales background. You even had that tech background doing things like QA. So looking around you in the marketing department, what did you do differently than other marketers with that background? Because earlier in my career, I had a chance to work with some major software companies. I was a consultant, and I was working with sales enablement. And frankly, the head of sales was a little frustrated with the field marketing group, because they didn't feel like they were getting enough leads from this major sports sponsorship they were doing. And so he introduced me to them and said, hey, have this guy write it. And so I think that, and it was successful. And I think the thing I did differently, and maybe I just got lucky, is it was a sponsorship. And so they were very focused on the branding of it, right? And where mine, since I've been working in sales enablement, I've been working every day with sales folks and talking about their quota and talking about these meetings, it was definitely a little more rubber meets the road of not just this overall branding thing. It tied into the brand, but it tied directly into getting conversations with sales about specific products. And I think that was successful. Not unique to someone working in sales. That's, I think, partly the difference between brand marketers and direct response marketers. And as we mentioned, you're a brand marketer now. But what did you do differently when you were now in that marketing role, that you've been in marketing roles since you've had that sales and tech experience and you've seen other marketers do?
Yeah, I think you know, in order to be a successful salesperson, I was okay. I was good, really good, to be honest. You had to have this kind of, I would say, like resilience, because you have to suffer of getting a lot of no's, right? It's build your character. And I think also, like, when you are spending time in the marketing, when you are running campaigns and events and trade shows and you're doing so many activities, it can be very intense. It can be very frustrating when you are creating the best campaign ever, but it doesn't deliver. You need to keep pushing. You need to create this kind of character when you have to, you know, just swallow and keep going. I give you a specific example. One of the company I work with, I came to manage. I can name the name, right?
It's fine with you. Yeah,
I know. Okay. So when I've joined the IBM as a marketing manager, the first role I did was the marketing manager of the system and the technology division, which is all the hardcore, old school IBM technology. You know, you can imagine, like, hardware and network and storage and such. And what I found out that there was a lacking of real case studies, refresh case study, that customer talking about the real benefit, the real challenges and such. And I work with a team of like 15 marketeers, something like that. And when I've started to ask some tough questions, why we don't have it, the answer I got, and you're getting that, you know, the corporates from time to time, hey, we tried that, it failed, we cannot create, you know, case studies, you know. And, you know, as a salesperson, ex-salesperson, when someone saying to me, no, you cannot do that, or we don't do that here, it's give me like a zest of motivation, I would say. By the end of the year, I had 10 case studies that served the sellers, you know, across the board. And for me, it was very, I would say, important win internally to convince people that you can bring new tactics or new approach or fresh, you know, perspective in order to gain your objectives. So you can imagine that after this kind of experience I had, the next time people say to me, no, we don't do that, I had some backup to convince them that I can do something else.
Yeah, we'll see about that. We'll see if we don't do that.
Okay.
So your next lesson, you say, just pretty straightforward, delegate. So I assume this is the lesson you learned as you've moved up in your career. How did you learn to delegate?
Yeah, so, you know, this kind of transition from sales to marketing, this is, as you mentioned, this is, was the right time for me to learn more about delegation. First of all, to acknowledge that my time carries premium value. So, and to be honest, it's something that is hard. It's not only moving from sales to marketing, it's moving from individual contributor into management role. My time has become a valuable resource. I had to understand that, to acknowledge that. It was hard for me in the beginning just to outsource some of the activities I'm doing for so long, and I think I did them okay, and hand over in them to other people on my team or outsource to freelancers. But the lesson I learned that in order to grow, you know, you need to release. You need to trust people. Otherwise, you will be, you know, you're going to stuck in the same spot for years. And it's like almost like a new skill I had to teach myself in order to grow. And it's something that really helped me to increase or to improve my impact and increase even, you know, to cross the road and get more and more responsibility to my role. So I had almost to understand that my time is precious and other people can do my role or my task as good as I myself once I train them or teach them and whatever, and it worked. And to be honest, and I try to teach this lesson to my employees as well.
I mean, can you give us a specific example of something you've delegated and how you did it? Because I think at a high level, we all understand this. I remember I was interviewing the owner of a business of an ad agency, and we're having this conversation. And the way the light bulb went off for him is he would look over all the financials for years. And so once he got this business coach at one point, and he said, and the business coach asked him, it's like, hey, you've looked over these financials for years. Have you, like, first of all, how good are you at math? And he's like, well, not really. I mean, my background's in creative, and that's why I had an ad agency. It's like, okay, so you're probably, first of all, not the best person to do this. Okay, you look over these financials for years. How many mistakes have you found? And he said, I have not found any mistakes. And so his business coach convinced him, it's like, this is something you just have to delegate and let someone else own. And yeah, maybe there's some long-term looking over things and making sure it's working well, but not the day-to-day that he'd been doing and wasting his time doing that. So can you think of a specific example of, yeah, what you say, I agree with, I think we all agree with, you know, you raise in your career, you have to delegate. But that's the biggest change for me. It was difficult going from, I can be hands-on in marketing and craft this exactly how it needs to be crafted, versus, okay, now I've got to trust someone else, not only to do this right, but to do it right by the deadline, you know? So any specific examples come to mind?
Yeah, I think it's easier for me, and I assume that everyone, is to delegate, project or task that, you know, I really don't like to do them. You know, it's easy to delegate those kind of stuff.
Right,
so yeah, I know that, yeah, so I really don't like, and I have no like any kind of advantage in logistics and processes and bureaucracy. I really hate it. So it's easy for me to delegate. The harder part of my role to delegate is those activities that I really love to do, and I think I'm good at that. I really love to create content. I'm a content creator. I'm writing hundreds of posts. I have a podcast. I'm running community. I really love it, but it's time-consuming work, you know. If someone, you know, creating blog posts and articles and produce this podcast, right? It's work. So those are the exact points that it's like fighting with myself, with my passion, with my heart, to relieve something, to let something go for someone else. It's almost like I'm saying goodbye to piece of my heart, you know.
Yeah.
So one of the specific cases I remember is creating some assets for the sellers, for the product marketing team, whatever. And I started to write down, you know, one pager and such, and then I found out that you know, someone else can do that like I do, even better. So I had to relieve this kind of passion I have and outsource or hand over it to someone else. And I'll tell you a secret. They did great, better than I. But it gave me the understanding that this is something I can replicate and do more and more and more. And of course, with the time I had, I could do something else that I have more like a relative like advantage, you know. Dealing with strategy or dealing with the structure of our my organization, or to establish a better network internally in the organization.
And I feel, frankly, one of the reasons we don't delegate too, especially as we're growing in our career, is we're more comfortable with those things, because the new things you have to do in that role, like you said, strategy, budget, meetings, all these things, like, they're newer and they're less comfortable and they're frankly a little scary. You don't have the blueprint for it already, right? You have a blog post, you've probably done 100, 1,000, you know, boom, I know how to do this. But let me ask you on the flip side. I agree with you about delegating, right? But is there something specific or things that you don't delegate? You're like, no, I cannot delegate this. And I'll give you an example. We once published a video called Copywriting for Marketing Leaders, Why You Should Never Delegate the Marketing Message and How to Get It Right. And I didn't come up with that. Our CEO, Flint McLaughlin, came up with that. I love that. And to me, writing has always been 80% content, 80% having something good to say, having something worth saying. The other 20% is just, you know, saying it well. And so that 80%, especially overall for the brand, the value proposition, those things. I mean, I think every marketing leader should be deeply involved in that. Then the execution of that, yes, that's where you delegate. And I could be wrong about any of that. But for you, like, is there something you're like, okay, this is piece I cannot delegate. I need to be deeply involved in it and understand it before I delegate other pieces around it to my team.
Definitely, yes. I can think about three domains or three topics when I insist to be deeply involved in. First of all, is the strategy. I mentioned in the beginning of our discussion that we had a very interesting and complex rebranding process. It took a year. Half of this time, 6 months, it was mainly discussions around the strategy. Which company are we? What is the DNA of the company? What is the ICP? What is the, you know, the core advantages or the core USP for us versus the market and the competitors? In those discussions, I was the sole marketeers in the room. There were the founders of the startup, the chief product officer, few consultants, and that's it. I was the sole marketeer because it's super sensitive. It's super strategic. And I create this kind of bridge from the strategy to the extended marketing team only once the strategy was established, not before of that. So strategy is number one. The second part, the second topic is numbers. Numbers. You know, in the end, my role as a marketing, this is my approach. We can open up a discussion around that. Is I need to contribute to the bottom line of the company. That's it. Okay. I'm not speaking in terms of leads or MQLs. I'm talking in meetings, opportunities, and actual budget. Actual ARR revenue. So anything that deals with the numbers, it's something that I'm into that very deeply. Together with my demand gen team, but I'm into that very deeply. It's super important for me. In the end, this is the contribution, the real contribution of marketing to the organization. And this is related to my own perspective about marketing as a department in the organization. Marketing for me, it's not a cost center, it's a profit center. And in order to back it up, I need to be into the numbers and ensure that we are heading to the right direction. So this is number two, numbers. And number three is all other sensitive, you know, activities that we are having. For instance, working with venture capitals, VCs, and investors. Highly, you know, sensitive in some cases, highly confidential and stuff. So these cases where it's like a mixture of business, but also with emotion, I'm trying to be in the front line.
Those are some great examples, very specific. So you mentioned working at some big companies, and you know, there's a lot of upside to working with a big brand. There can be some challenges too. One of the challenges you mentioned, understand the rules of the game and set your own boundaries according to your values. So what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so when you're working on these big giants organization, we are talking about thousands of marketeers, between hundreds to thousands of marketeers. On top of that, additional stakeholders, you know, from sales, product, operation, and such. You need to know how to navigate in this domain to better understand, you know, the politics, the unspoken rules, the things that are hidden from our eyes. In some cases, is very confusing. It's very confusing to make the right decisions or to engage with the right people. And you can find yourself in a very complex or sensitive situation. So what I'm referring to is to find, and maybe it will sound, you know, weird to your ears, but to understand who are you as a person. First of all, what are your values, what you are willing to do and what you are not willing to do in order to meet your own objectives. It can be very, tough in those dynamics. I can tell you that more than one time, I make some decision that impact my career because I didn't want to cross boundaries. It's hard for me to jump into a specific examples at this stage, but it's something that is related to a gray area between reaching numbers and hitting the targets and my values. In those cases, I'm trying to really listen to myself, to my core, and make the right decisions. And in some cases, it was also related to a very aggressive behavior of other people. So I need to take a stance and put some lines over there. So these are the type of cases when I go back to the whiteboard and try to figure out what I'm willing to do and what I will not do.
Yeah, and so I mean, what you're talking about, I assume we could call office politics. And it what has been the difference between working for some of the biggest brands in the world, mentioned IBM, Microsoft, Amazon, and working for startups? Because, and yeah, I've had a chance to work with both too. And what I hear, it's so funny, like if I talk to colleagues now that are some very big companies, you know, that's their complaints. It's office politics. You can't get anything done. It takes forever to get things done. They don't notice me. I'm lost, blah, 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 right? And then when I talk to people at the small companies, the startups, it's like, people don't know our brand. We don't have the budget. We don't have the resources. I don't have the skills. I can't compete with the big companies with their technology, right? So it's always like, you know, the grass is always greener, right? But you've done both. So what has been your experience? Like if you had to break it down, like the pros and cons of the big brands as the biggest organizations in the world and the startups, what would you say?
Yeah. First of all, you know, where you see people, you see politics. So politics is everywhere. It's us as people, you know, you can decide that you are not playing this game, but there will be some impact. You know, so you have to play the game. You can create your own rules and your own boundaries, but not playing the game will damage you and your career. I'm super honest, super open. However, there are some few differences between working for a big corporation and a small startup. First of all, you see the people. At corporates, it's really easier for people to play stick and hike, and not see you at the office, I would say. But in a small startup, those are the people you are sitting next to, you are eating lunch with. You cannot hide from those people. So the communication is more direct, is more open. And this is, for me, this is like a good side because it's really related to my character as a person, as a human being. But it's tougher. You need to, tackle directly some of the issues, some of the problems. Where in corporation, because of the more complex structure, you have a lot of layers and hidden agenda. It's more complex. It's almost like trying to control the puppets. I don't know. So again, there are some good sides and bad sides for each of the organization's structures. To be honest, I'm really happy I did both because it really gave me a perspective. You cannot win them all. There are some, advantages working for a big corporation. You have the budget, you had a lot of people, you can gain some expertise in specific domains. While in startup, in most of the cases, you have like budget constraints. You are always in a hurry because, startup, innovative, very dynamic and competitive landscape. But to be honest, after spending around 20 years in corporation, I really enjoy my last years working back with startups. My recommendation for people, if you have the chance to work in both sides of the spectrum, I would say do that. It will make you a better professional.
Well, I love how you say it's not the organization, it's people. When there are people, there are politics. And in the second half of the episode, we're going to talk about people you collaborate with and lessons you learned. But first, I should mention that the How I Made It in Marketing podcast is underwritten by MechLabs, the parent organization of Marketing Sherpa. MechLabs AI now has 13 expert assistants to help you with your marketing, along with a guided headline writing path to write a powerful headline, all trained on a methodology built on the results from 10,000 marketing experiments. It's totally free to use for now. You don't even have to. So just go to mechlabsai.com and start using it. That's mechlabsai.com to start getting artificial intelligence working for you. So here's your first lesson. As I mentioned, we're going to talk about some lessons you learn from people you collaborate with. Time is your most precious asset. You were kind of hinting at this when we talked about delegation. You said you learned this from Alon Raphael. How did you learn this from Alon?
So, it's funny because this is like a lesson that really something that, you know, he said to me like many years ago, 15 years ago, something like that. We are still in touch. He became like a friend, and we are doing like a mutual mentoring, I would say. But he teach me that the importance of dedicating my time to areas where I have the significant value. And this is something, as I mentioned in the beginning of our conversation, it was really hard for me to understand in the beginning because I pushed that back. But this lesson is critical when working with the team. But it also, resonate, in this area of generative AI, going back to what we're doing today. And I feel that on a daily basis, going back to the things I mentioned in, a few minutes ago about creating those posts and content and such. Now I can save a lot of time using Gen AI tools, and they are really saving a lot of time. I assume you have this kind gained some experience working with the ChatGPT or other tools. If you know how to work with them in a very methodological way, you can spare, I believe, around 60-70% of your time. So it's not only like saving your time or delegating to other people, you can delegate to tools. And now we have the technology that you can outsource your day-to-day work, that you don't have a competitive edge to add on top of that, to AI tools that are very intelligent, they're very efficient, they're very fast. And once you delegate those tasks to AI tools, you can focus more on tasks or project that as a human being have an edge. You can invest more in being creative, using more of your imagination, or using your soft skills to collaborate with other people. In the beginning, it was hard because how AI tool can write better than me? But they can. You are in the end. I see that, by the way, when we are doing, I'm talking about myself. I said that I really don't love, those endless processes and such. We are not good in repetitive work, us as human being. We tend to be tired, doing mistakes, you see that a lot. But once you outsource those repetitive tasks into for machines, for AI, you can save a lot of time, precious time, and do other tasks that are more important from a strategy point of view.
Let me ask you, that's a great point. Then how do you stay an indispensable asset to your company in an era of generative AI? So for example, I interviewed Christian Givago about this way before AI, like 10 or 15 years ago. And her answer was, you got to keep learning about new technology. You got to measure your campaigns. But one of the really key things I liked was you have to focus on understanding the customer better than anyone else in the organization, right? And she would talk about regularly interviewing customers in person on the phone to really understand them, right? And that's how you became an indispensable asset even before AI. But now, you talk about it's such a quickly changing environment with generative AI. It can do more and more every day. How do you stay an indispensable asset to your company?
Yeah, it's a good question. To be honest, maybe my answer will change a year from now because it's really hard to capture the market. The growth is enormous. But I found I can talk about a few things. First of all, is our ability to orchestrate more than one tool. So think about now as a marketing manager, I have a team of 10 marketeers, as you mentioned at the beginning, but on top of that, I have some virtual workers. They are AI agents and AI avatars. This is what DID does. So when I'm looking about the organization structure of my marketing department, I have real human beings, but I have also some virtual marketeers there. And my advantage as a human being, as a human manager, I would say, is first of all, is to motivate my human employees and encourage them to use more of the technology, like the avatar and the agents, the AI agents, in order to benefit more. So I'm leveraging my own virtues and capabilities as a human being to generate this kind of motivation and passion, and to encourage to do experiments, for instance, to make mistakes. You know, I believe AI, you know, if they are doing mistakes, they say sorry, apologize, whatever. No, I'm allocating a certain amount of my marketing budget for experiments, and if someone is failing, that's fine, you know. And this is like a human character. This is my own, you know, virtues as a human being, because this is going back to my belief. I don't know what are the beliefs of ChatGPT, but I really know my belief, my own beliefs and my own values. So this is like the places where it's more than a tool, like a functional, you know, skill set or something like that. It's before of that. It's around, it's big words about inspiration, okay? About motivation, about empathy. Those are the places where AI, generative AI, cannot bring value, or at least not as much human being can.
No, that's great. And I love what you say about the failing and experiment. I mean, I've heard it said, if you're not failing sometimes, then you're failing because you're not pushing it hard enough, right? I mean, I'm sure each one of us could be successful 100% of the time if we just stayed in, you know, what we're comfortable with. But to really push it, you got to be failing sometimes, because then you're really pushing the envelope.
Definitely. And, you know, this is when people talking about the imposter syndrome, I'm always saying, okay, that's good. It means that you are walking away from your comfort zone. You are trying new stuff. It's a good signal. That's okay. Completely fine.
I love that. So earlier you were talking about how important the numbers were to you, recurring revenue. And you here's one of your lessons you learned from someone: without clear and identifiable goals, you don't know if you are effective, improving, or contributing. So it sounds like you learned that pretty early in your career. How'd you learn that?
Yeah, it's really happened in the beginning of my own journey as a sales manager at Microsoft. I, you know, many years ago, but I really remember that. I was on my way to a meeting with a potential client, a companion with by a senior manager for one of our partners, technology partners. And we had, we had a meeting. I spent, I think, in this role only a few months. And after the meeting, this person, he was like senior than me and more experienced than me. And he asked me a very direct question that really confused me. He asked me, what are your goals? And this might seems very, very basic question, but for me, it was, first of all, very confusing and very significant. And, you know, I remember that although many years have passed away, and I realized once he asked me that I really don't know the answer, because my manager at that time didn't, you know, gave me any clear goals or KPIs. Now, without goals and KPIs, you don't have a compass. You don't know if you are winning or losing, if you are gaining real contribution to the organization or not. So it struck me. And after I went back to the office, I went to my manager and asked him for a very specific direction. And this is something I'm trying to do all the time. Okay? Set clear KPIs and goals. They can be quantitative, like sales quota and such, but they can also be qualitative, can be even soft KPIs. That's fine. But just show the people the way. People would like to understand if they are gaining a progress or not, if they are heading to the right direction or not. Otherwise, it's a waste of time. It's even unfair for your employees or for your colleagues if they don't know what is the road and what is the direction. So, you know, be a spotlight.
Well, can you give us a specific example of a goal you either set for yourself or someone on your team and how you came up with that goal? Because at Marketing Sherpa, we did benchmark reports. And one thing we would ask is, you know, what goals marketers have. And I was looking at an old chart about email marketing, and it struck me that the top choice, it was exactly, I think, 67% each or whatever. It was exactly tied. It was between delivering highly relevant content, getting additional traffic, and increasing revenue. And I thought, that's a great example of how we as marketers get torn sometimes, right? Because you got to serve the customer. You got to get more brand interest at the top of the funnel. You got to get hard revenue, right? And so, well, then what becomes, is everything a goal? Or, you know, do you have to prioritize goals, right? So can you give us an example, kind of walk us through in your mind, like how you set a specific goal for yourself or someone on your team?
Yeah. So I think the easier goals is those hard-coded goals, okay? You have numbers to bring. You need to generate revenue for the company, going up into the funnel, how many opportunities, how many meetings, how many MQLs, how many leads, and such. These are, you know, maybe tough to achieve, but easy to define. You can see them. You can track them. I think the more complex goals are the soft goals, okay? The goals that can show this kind of progress. We talked about content, okay? So I've started to measure the type of content we are creating. There is like indirect impact of those KPIs on the hard-coded KPIs, obviously, but I wanted to measure the quality of the content, okay? It's great that we're creating content, and now with the Gen AI, it's really easy to create content, right? But I want to create the best content there is. We need to measure that. So measuring the number of pieces of content we're creating is nice, but also about the consumption rate of those content and the ranking of this content and how this content really serve the strategy of the company. I can tell you now at DID, where I've started to focus on specific industries like telco, insurance, and such. So I've started to move away from like horizon, like generic, you know, type of assets into more specific or industry-oriented content. This is a KPI. How many assets we are going to create for the insurance industry or for the commerce industry and such. So this is one thing. The other thing is like completely soft goals. And this is the question I'm asking my team members from time to time. What have you learned this week? Okay. And this is part of my philosophy as a manager. I want to challenge my teammates. I want to challenge my workers to encourage them to learn something new. And this for me, this is one of the KPIs. So I'm trying to allocate budget for people to learn more, to develop more. And this is not less important than reaching to the next, you know, milestone and achieving the next meeting with the prospect.
So you mentioned something really enticing I don't want to overlook. You mentioned you're measuring the quality of content. So I want to understand how you do that, because especially in the age of AI, I mean, that was hard before, right? Especially, you know, when marketers are challenged with, do I outsource this to like a content farm somewhere, or do I get, you know, a really high dollar writer or whatever to do this, right? With AI, it's become even harder. And for example, we have this AI guild with a group, you know, that we're working on artificial intelligence. And as I mentioned, we have MechLabs AI. And, you know, one of these marketers was showing me like, oh, ChatGPT gave me these 10 headlines and blah, blah, blah. Why should I even mess with MechLabs AI? And, you know, I was like, okay. But then we started looking at the screen and here's the 10 headlines from ChatGPT and here's the 10 headlines from MechLabs AI. And ChatGPT is great. So this is just a specific example. I'm not trying to diss them. But I looked and it's like, okay, look at those headlines from ChatGPT. It goes like this. You get 10 headlines right away, but then you forget. You don't look like, they're not very good, you know, versus, okay, here are the headlines that are better. Yeah. And I think in the age of AI sometimes, and again, this isn't particularly new to AI. This happened with content outsourcing 15, 20 years ago. In the age of AI, it seems like such a magic trick sometimes where it's like, oh my gosh, I put this information in and stuff comes out. And we give this false trust to it. And I've done this. I was writing, for example, a blog post about this very topic, about how we can't overly trust AI. I put in a transcript or a chat log from one of our AI guild meetings into it. I put it into the AI. I asked it to summarize and I published that. And I didn't even notice. Someone pointed out to me, wait a minute, we didn't talk about landing page optimization. We talked about whatever other topic, right? So in that age of AI, how are you measuring the quality of content? I feel like we're just kind of sometimes mesmerized by this magic trick that we overlook that not all of it's high quality.
I totally agree. I think it's getting easier and easier to create content. You don't have to be like the ideal content creator in order to create content. And it's very tempting to create a lot of content, but most of the content created by AI is mediocre. It's not the best. You need to work. You need to polish that. So I'm talking about they can help you, those two, to cross like 60-70% of your journey. But then you need to add your own voice, your own perspective. And I have to be honest, I encourage my team members to use ChatGPT and Gemini and Claude and such tools, because I truly believe about their values. More than that, I'm hiring only people with experience working with Gen AI tools to my department. So it's a mandatory requirement for me as a VP of marketing to hire people that deal with Gen AI. Now, Gen AI brings more complexities, because once everyone creating more content, it's getting harder to stand out because you have so many alternatives. And my focus is on the last mile, those 20%. To give specific examples, you know, adding the authentic voice of the brand, of the company. Who are we as a company? And also to bring the authentic voice of the writer, my own style of writing or my team. So it's important. Now, measuring the quality of the content can be using some scales and ranking, and this is something that I'm now deploying on my website, because you know, without getting the feedback from the audience, you almost like blind. So you think you create the best content, you know, ever, but it should meet the expectation of the audience. So you need to get some feedback. So this feedback can be with the reaction of people that consuming and reading the content on the blog or the website and such, but also to speak with real customers and ask them, is this help you? Now, working in the B2B organization, it's easier for me to make this cross-checking, because we have sellers that meet real customers, and I encourage my team members to meet those customers, and we are using assets in the sales process, and I get in feedback if those assets really helpful or not. And we are getting, you know, the salespeople can be very aggressive going back, hey, this is like a shitty whatever paper. And I'm going back to the beginning of our discussion again, my own personal experience working in sales, I really have like allergies for marketing fluff. Okay, I want the content to be very specific, hard coded. I call it like this type of assets is very common. Like, what is the reason to believe? Give me facts, give me figures, give me statistics, give me real examples. This is more compelling. And for me, this is like a few of the directions or the ways to measure the quality of the content.
So just so I'm clear though, when you talk about scaling, is it a thumbs up, thumbs down on the webpage? Is it a 1 to 10? Like, do you actually have something on the content where customers are ranking it?
I'm optimizing now. Now, thumb up, thumb down is nice, but it's not enough. I would like numbers. I need a scale. Good or bad is nice, but it's not enough for me. I would like to rank them. Now, once I have this kind of ranking, it will be easier for me, first of all, to better understand what are the expectations of the audience, of the visitors. And also, it's more important to create the right content for my paid campaigns. I'm talking about organic, you know, content. But now when I'm spending dollars on that, I need to be very, very precise. So do I use the right assets? And I can think about a third advantage is to ensure that the content I create as a marketing manager meets the company strategy. For instance, if I've seen a lot of on the scale 1 to 5, a lot of 5 of a content that has no connection to the current strategy of the company in 2024, it's great I'm getting 5, but there is a gap between my content and the strategy of the company. It's a bad sign, but I need to measure that.
Yeah, I remember talking to a major marketing company, and they just put out so many blog posts. And some of them seem so disconnected from their brand, like you talk about their value proposition. And I was sitting down with this one of the marketing managers or someone at one point, and I was asking, well, I don't understand the strategy there. And they're like, well, we got a lot of interns, we got a lot of junior marketers, we got to get a certain amount of leads from the blog every month. And so we just write about everything. And
it's almost like you're working for the SEO. You know?
Yes, exactly. That's another machine you got to be careful not to work for.
I know. And by the way, now it's getting harder and harder because, you know, the SEO world is changing using Gen AI. It's not only search engine, it's like chats. It's a different type of SEO. So, and we are learning that, by the way, this kind of methods. And we have started to change the way we create content and the right format for the content. Because things that work in the past for Google search are not working for Gemini or work differently for Gemini or ChatGPT or other chatbots. So we need to adjust the type of content and the structure of the content in order to meet the new algorithm.
Can you think of any specific examples? Are you talking about FAQs, short form versus long form, snippets? Like what is there a specific thing you're doing differently for AI?
Yeah, we found out, for instance, that those tools really love like a structure formats. Like tables, you don't have to show the borders of the tables, but once the output, the content is built in the format of the table, it's easier for those tools to capture the data. So we have started to work with some consultant in order to change the way we create content, because now still, okay, Google search, Bing, whatever, they'll still dominate the world, but within 1 year, 2 years, all the practices that we are doing in SEO for the last 20 years are going to the trash. We need to adjust ourselves to a new type of methods.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I would suggest to look at your analytics, because when I'm looking at our refers, you know, it's the traditional, you know, Googles, whatever, but you're starting to see like ChatGPT and some of the AI engines be getting there too. So you mentioned one last lesson here. Networking is a talent and a skill. How did you learn this lesson?
To be honest, I learned that from my mother. she is a very social person. So I learned from him as a boy. But from a business perspective, I think the first time I learned the power of being a great networker was one of the first my first day as a salesperson. I joined one of the seasoned sales account executive in a big conference, and it was like a big customer event. And she had been with the company for a few years. She was like senior than me, very experienced. And throughout the event, I noticed that both existing and potential clients approach her, engage in conversation with her, and vice versa. She was like simply a magnet. So people reach to her, come to her. She make this kind of connection between people and capture some opportunities and leads. It was almost, for me, it was like overwhelming. It was like a pure magic to see how the personality of the person popped out in those interactions with real people and how you can translate those interactions into business. So for me, networking or being a networker is an asset. And I can tell you that I'm allocating a certain amount of my time every week to meet with people. I'm trying to secure this time. For me, it's like a very precious time to spend with real people and converse with them and learn with them. And the network, the power, we talked about, you know, the differences between AI and people and human beings. This is one of the differences. People prefer to connect with other people. This is how evolution made us human beings. And why not to make the most of it?
So I agree. The struggle I've always had is I'm a super introverted guy, right? So I've always struggled with this. So let me ask you, I think you're a pretty good networker on LinkedIn, right? So do you have any specific tips or tactics or what works, what doesn't when it comes to LinkedIn networking? I got to admit, like I said, I'm introverted. I'm less of a reach out type of person, unless there's something real specific. It's someone I used to work with. I see them mentioned in the Wall Street Journal or something like that. Or, you know, there's some real specific thing like that. But what I get mostly, honestly, is just endless BDR, SDR type of sales requests, you know, like, oh my gosh, we got to get on a calendar and talk about whatever the thing I'm selling. And that, you know, occasionally I get those real genuine networking, but it's just become such a flood of that. So do you have any specific tips of something that's worked for you there?
Yeah, many tips. I can speak about talk about LinkedIn for hours. So I mean, it's just like a warning. This is like a warning. I have a few tens of followers and connections on LinkedIn. For me, it's like a gold mine. But over the time, I've started to look on the networking on LinkedIn in more strategic way. And it started with my own objectives. And based on my own objective, I defined the type of network I would like to establish. And it's very important because there are some few approaches, like, are you going to approach to any person? You know, are you going to accept any kind of connection request? What are the boundaries? What is your strategy? So I'm trying to be very structured in that way and accept only connection requests that meets my own objective now. And in some cases, I hope nobody will get offended. In some cases, I deleted, you know, all connections that doesn't serve my current objective in 2024. Maybe I engaged with them like 15 years ago. So first of all, my first tip is think about on your network as a tool, okay? And you need to, for this tool to be sharp and ready and serve you now, not things you did in the past, but for now and in the near future. So this is one thing. The other thing is that if you identified some of important people you would like to engage with, okay, and currently you are not connected, in some cases, when you are sending a connection request too soon, you are going to be rejected. So what my tip for anyone that would like to approach, like a senior, you know, executive or any kind of influencer and such, try to cook this relationship in advance, okay? Identify this person, spread some likes, comment on post. It's super, super important. Establish your own brand as an expert, you know, create this kind of awareness to your presence. And only once you think you establish this kind of connection, send the first connection request. And it's happening. Most of the people don't act like that. Now, going back to the what you mentioned about those SDRs or BDRs approach, that this is really bad practice coming from sellers that don't understand that the operating on LinkedIn is very similar to the real life, okay? You're walking down the road. You're not approaching to any stranger, right? Someone will call the police. So don't take those practices and bring them to the virtual world. It's the same. It's people. LinkedIn is not a platform for lead generation. It's a platform for creating or establishing relationship. And relationship is something that is very fragile. You need to gain trust. Without trust, you will not do sales. So if someone approached you, I'm telling you what I'm doing. If someone approached you just after I'm accepting a connection request and trying to pitch me, I block them. I delete them. Okay. For me, they're not professionals and I don't want to waste my time.
Amen, brother. Amen. Preach it. I love it. So that's some great advice for LinkedIn. Well, Tomer, we talked about so many different things about what it means to be a marketer from all your different stories, from all your different lessons. If you had to break it down, what are the key qualities of an effective marketer?
Wow. I think, you know, the marketing discipline has went through so many changes during the last 20, 25 years, you know, the digital marketing and the mobile marketing and now using AI, a lot of practice, you know, remote working, many revolutions and such. I think for me, it's still valid. It's still important are the following things. First of all, I think curiosity for a good marketing need to be very curious. You need to learn a lot. You need to care about people. In the end, it's people and it's the insights from people. It can be like consumers, can be organization, like companies, businesses and such, but you need to care about them and about their interest and understand their needs and motivation. So curiosity is number one. The second, I would say quality is, I would say be bold. Okay, boldness for me is like a virtue of a good marketer. I think we discussed about that. If you are staying in your comfort zone, you will be okay. But okay is not enough. The market is super, super competitive. And in order to stand out, you need to take some bold moves. And it's okay to make mistakes. Calculated mistakes, you know, whatever. But be bold. And for me, being bold, by the way, it's not only to do those crazy creative campaigns in the Super Bowl, whatever. Being bold is to be committed to your numbers. Being bold is say, hey, I'm not measuring myself on leads. I'm measuring myself on real revenue coming to the company. Don't hide behind the marketing art, you know. Marketing is a profession. So be professional, committed to your numbers. So for me, it's like this kind of, you know, I would say balance between being professional, be like a people-oriented person, and be bold. Yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing all of the bold lessons from your career, Tomer. I learned a lot. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It was fun.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. And thank you to everyone for listening. I hope you learned a lot.
Thank you for joining us for How I Made It in Marketing with Daniel Burstein. Now that you've gotten inspiration for transforming yourself as a marketer, get some ideas for your next marketing campaign from Marketing Sherpa's extensive library of free case studies at marketingsherpa.com. That's marketingsherpa.com.